From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the rumor is that the cold snap is finally behind us. We'll do a reality check with Mike Westendorf. Later, water, the freeze-thaw cycle, and how it can affect your home. The head of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF talks about visiting kids in danger and not always being able to help.
It's really hard sometimes, even something as silly as knowing I have a bag of Jolly Ranchers in my backpack and there's children in front of me, and I find myself mentally counting, how many kids and how many do I think I have in the bag.
And we'll learn about the parrot that inspired writer Jane Kelly's latest novel for young readers.
He wasn't bred to be particularly brilliant, but it turned out that he was, because he could identify shapes and colors and concepts like numbers.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Just after 8 o'clock Sunday night, the official temperature at General Mitchell International Airport fell below zero. And it stayed there nonstop till about 3 o'clock yesterday afternoon, when it briefly climbed to 1 degree above zero before falling right back down again. Temperatures are below zero again this morning, though the end appears to be in sight. We've been hearing about the so-called polar vortex for a while, but how did reality compare to the expectations? And where do things go from here? Mike Westendorf is Director of Operations for Innovative Weather at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and he joins us this morning via Skype. Good morning, Mike.
How you doing, Mitch?
I'm warming up. How about you?
Thawing out, yes.
Well, let's do kind of a reality check on this cold snap, which is not quite over, but it sounds like it's almost over. How cold did it get in the Milwaukee area in terms of both air temperature and wind chill?
So it looks like the National Weather Service did a nice little summary page on some of these things. And our coldest temperature, at least officially in Milwaukee, was about 13 degrees below zero. Outlying areas were colder than that. I think Waukesha was down in the the upper teens below zero, which sounds funny to say. So about minus 13, and the high temperature on January 6th was minus 4. And these kind of compare. You got to go back a good 10, 15 years to be able to find something of this kind of cold in terms of the similarities between it.
Well, we had been hearing for some time before the cold actually got here that it was on its way. How did the actual extent of this cold snap compare to what you and other meteorologists expected via computer modeling?
I think that it turned out pretty well. We had seen this idea that the longer range models, when something big is happening in the atmosphere, the longer range models tend to have a greater degree of accuracy, or we have more confidence in what's happening. And they had been showing for a good 7 to 9 days out this idea of this kind of cold coming south. Historically, or at least typically, what you'll see is that doesn't quite happen. The cold air gets in here, yes, but it's never quite the whole polar vortex cold that we experienced. This one actually did really break out, and for it was consistently in the models and came right on through. I think that for me, the one thing that I was a little surprised at was how much wind we had. You go back to 1996, which is when the last major cold like this really hit us. That's what we were kind of comparing it to from a model standpoint. I think that because we had so much wind, the actual air temperatures didn't get quite as cold as the, 22 to 24, 25 degrees below zero. But we did see those wind chills, just absolutely brutal. And I think that that's really what makes this cold snap stand out, is that not only did we have the cold, we had the wind for, almost right on through yesterday afternoon. We were still dealing with 25 degrees below zero wind chills.
Well, and that's interesting, because it sounds like what you're saying is the wind created these really cold wind chills, but it also kept the air temperature from falling further than it did. Is that right?
Right. So the idea, the reason why we're cold this morning, for example, the worst of the cold is gone, at least atmospherically. The vortex is moving out. We've got the residual cold that's lingering. But what happened overnight was that we had light winds and clear skies, and that allows any heat that we did accumulate from solar radiation during the day to just simply escape out into space. The clouds oftentimes offer us a blanket. They will keep temperatures from falling off. And in the wintertime, especially when there's snow on the ground, you can get what you call a dew point crash, where the air becomes very, very dry. It allows the temperatures to fall off to the dew point. Dew point puts a little bit of basically a little bit of moisture, kind of condenses out on the ice. Dew point drops, the temperatures drop. And so it's not uncommon on clear skies, light wind nights, to see those temperatures just plummet. And this morning was some of that evidence, minus 5 to minus 12 around southeastern Wisconsin. But if you've got the wind in clear skies, that wind allows the atmosphere to remain mixed up. And so the temperatures may not be quite as cold a few thousand feet above us, and that wind mixes that down and keeps us from falling off to the more extreme levels.
The temperature remained below zero for almost two straight days and really never climbed much above zero. So you could almost say it's been there for 2.5 days at this point. Yep. Is it common in this part of the state and in this part of the country for things to stay so cold for so long?
Not common, but not rare would probably be a good way to put it. You know, we're comparing back to 1996. There was another cold stretch that was back in 1999 as well. And so it happens, but the stretch that we're talking about is a little bit more rare. It's not something that you see a lot. In fact, a lot of our staff who is in college students, this was some of the coldest air that they've experienced really in their lifetime, where they actually weren't told to just stay outside. You had to go outside. You couldn't just stay inside, you know.
One of the things that that people were saying over the course of this this cold snap is, well, thank goodness it isn't snowing out there. And indeed, there are some people saying that it was too cold to snow. That's something we hear a lot. Is it ever possible to be too cold to snow, or is it just not very common that it snows when it's that cold?
That's more to the point. It's just not as common, especially in our part of the state. You know, the folks up in Alaska, they see snow at minus 20, minus 40. So it snows there. You have to have moisture. You have to have lift. And the temperature is below freezing. That's all you need for snow. But what in Wisconsin, anyways, when we get our cold, most of the time, again, it's in the wake of one of those bigger storm systems that pulls a lot of that cold Canadian air south. And then the winds drop, the skies clear out, we've got fresh snow, and those temperatures plummet. And so there's sometimes that illusion that it can't snow because it's that cold. But no, it can snow. And a lot of folks in the country have seen it.
It really just isn't snowing because it's sunny.
Right. Exactly.
What should we expect? The temperatures, I gather, are on the way up. How far are they likely to climb?
Well, this is the interesting part of this. You know, since mid-October, we have been stuck in a pattern that sees basically out of 7 days in the week, one day is above normal, one day is seasonal, and everything else is below normal. And when you're heading into winter, that's a little depressing because it means November comes in October, December comes, you know, in November, and January comes in December. And that's what we've been experiencing for some time now. We've been waiting for something to break this pattern, and the fact that we had the vortex came south, which means basically that the jet stream just take a huge dive southward. Well, now as it lifts and it pulls out, the jet stream rearranges itself for a few days, and really later on this weekend, beginning on Friday through the early part of next week, we're going to have a little bit of a January thaw. And so that's developing. You'll start to notice it more so tomorrow evening as temperatures continue rising into Friday. But there's a problem with this one, Mitch. And that is that we're probably going to see the potential for rain and freezing rain as it gets in here. And it's interesting because the atmosphere warms up so quickly. It just pushes a surge of moisture through. The storm system itself is not particularly organized, but it brings a lot of moisture in. And given the fact that we've been below zero for 2 days, my concern is that even though the atmosphere may warm up enough for it to fall as rain, when it hits the ground, you're going to see a lot of ice. And I think that that's going to be the case as you get into Friday and Friday night. There's some indications with the latest models just coming out this morning that another system rides up the backside of this front and may extend a chance for some light snow on top of that into Saturday morning. So it's one of those be careful what you wish for, because, you know, when things change abruptly, weather is one of the things that happens.
Mike Westendorf, thanks so much. Stay warm.
Yeah, you bet. You too.
Mike Westendorf is Director of Operations for Innovative Weather at UW-Milwaukee. He joined us via Skype this morning, and you can always find the latest forecast at wuwm.com/weather. We'll take a quick break now, and in just a moment, the downside to the January thaw, the damage that the freeze-thaw cycle can cause to your home. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. As Mike Westendorf mentioned before the break, a January thaw is on its way by later this week. And while that will undoubtedly be a relief after several days and nights of below zero temperatures, the rapid warm-up also comes with some hazards, especially for homeowners. The buildup of ice along roofs and gutters can lead to sudden problems when the ice melts and then refreezes. Mike Wood is sales manager at Callan Construction in Milwaukee. Last spring, he explained to Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce where the areas of greatest concern are.
Well, with what we deal with, many times we're dealing with issues with the roof and the gutters and soffit and fascia and things like that. So what happens during the day is that snow and ice that sits up on the roof melts and it runs down the roof. The water runs down the roof towards the gutters and it gets towards the bottom edge of the roof by the eaves. It refreezes. And when it refreezes, it causes ice damming. And that ice damming can cause things like water stains inside the home, water dripping through your soffits. It can actually push gutters off the home. It can damage your shingles. There's a lot of different things that it can do.
So then how do you advise homeowners to protect themselves from this? I mean, it's all going on above you, kind of out of reach. So what are some steps that homeowners can take to prep for this time of year?
There's really two parts to it. There's preventive maintenance, and then once it happens, there's other things that you can do. The first thing is that if we can keep your attic space the exact same temperature as the outside air, you're going to have less of it. So if you think about it being, you know, 25 degrees outside during the day, but if your attic space is 40 degrees, you're going to have that heat rising and melting more of that snow and running off. So if we can keep your attic space down in that 25-degree range, we're going to be better off. And the ways that we do that are through proper insulation in your attic so that the heat from your home isn't rising up and getting in that attic space and melting the snow. And then also, secondly, proper ventilation so that, you know, you're going to get some solar radiation that warms up that attic space as well. If you properly ventilate that and get air moving through there, you're going to keep that temperature low as well. So the more that we can prevent from melting and then refreezing later, the better off we're going to be. Being in Wisconsin, you're always going to have some amount of ice damming because your shingles are going to absorb a lot of the heat from the sun. So if we can take steps while this is happening to help prevent that ice damming from occurring, that helps too. And the biggest way that you do that is through roof raking. And roof raking is where, you know, we have a big snowfall, anything, you know, 2 to 3 inches or more. Within 24 hours of that snowfall, we want to get outside and scrape off the snow from the first 2 to 3 feet of our roof, because what that does is that frees that bottom area up so that as the water does run down, it doesn't get stuck in the snow and it gets right down to the gutter and right off the roof. But the key there is that you have to do it within 24 hours, because if you wait too long, it freezes up, it gets too hard, and now people start chopping away at it with those roof rakes, and now they actually start damaging their shingles if they wait too long.
Do these ice dams also pose a risk to the gutters themselves?
They can, because, well, ice is a lot denser than snow. It's as dense as you can get because it's solid water, and it's a lot heavier than snow, and it also expands. So as it expands, it pushes gutters away from the fascia. We've seen extreme cases where it can actually push the gutters right off of the home. Every gutter, even if they're seamless gutters, has seams on the end caps or where the mitered corners come together. If you get a little bit of water in there and then it refreezes, it pushes that apart, and that eventually causes those seams to leak. We see ice when it gets in the downspouts. One thing a lot of people don't notice is the seams on the downspouts are behind the downspouts against the house. So if you look around behind them, depending on the gauge of the downspout that you put on there, there's a possibility that your downspouts, as they freeze, they're actually going to open up and those seams are going to split open, and they don't go back together. So you have to replace them once that happens. So anything you can do to prevent that and keep that stuff from happening over time is going to cause less damage.
And it will definitely save you some money in the long run from having to replace those gutters.
That's right. It definitely will. I mean, there's a couple other things that you can do. You know, you can do heater cables. That's where if there are certain areas, maybe on a second floor, where you can't reach it with a roof rake, or maybe your health isn't in a condition where you can get out there and rake the roof every time it snows. So You have to do this before it snows, though, but you can have heater cables put up where they zigzag some wire up and down about the first 2 to 3 feet of the roof all the way along the eave, and then they run it back through the – one run back through the gutter, so it's a big loop. And if you put that on, that'll help melt off some of that snow and ice, and many times we'll actually run it up the downspout and back down the downspout as well, so it'll keep the whole thing free-flowing. The other thing that you can do is just kind of a tip if you do get some ice damming that – you need to get rid of. It's causing problems, but you don't want to chop away at it. You know, a tip that has been around for years, or a little trick, is you can take some pantyhose and fill it with calcium chloride. And calcium chloride is like a salt, you know, that you use for your sidewalks, but it's a little safer for your roof. And it ends up being like a long snake, and you can lay it right on top of the ice dam. So what that does is that controls the release and the melting of that calcium chloride or salt into just the ice dam area, and it'll wash away. It'll help free some of that stuff up. It's not really a great solution, but it's in an emergency situation or sometime when you have to get it free or get it out of there. That works too.
So what should homeowners be looking for? Say they haven't taken some of these preventative measures, taken some of these preventative steps. What should a homeowner be looking for to make sure that they're not running into a potentially damaging and costly problem with their roofs?
Well, the first and foremost and the most concerning is if you see any water spots inside your home, and you're typically going to see them along the outside edge of the walls. If you do see a spot, you know, like an inch or two in diameter, keep in mind that's the tip of the iceberg. You probably have a good foot or two of damp or wet insulation up in the attic. So you want to make sure that it's the moment you see that, you have to realize that you've got a problem. You also want to look for on the outsides by the soffits if you see any water dripping through the soffit. Yes, technically it's outside the home out there. It's not touching your drywall, but it's going through your attic, and that water will eventually rot out that wood that's inside there. So as we continue to work our way out, the other place you could see water dripping would be between the gutter and the fascia board. That's not as concerning. You know, that just means that your gutters have filled up with some water or ice, and they've filled up to the top, and they're starting to overflow, and they might be overflowing on the backside rather than the front side. Still would rather not see it, but that's not as bad as if you see them either through your soffits or from the inside of the house. That's typically what you're going to look for water. The other thing that you can look for that I highly recommend, take a look at your chimney on the outside. A lot of times in our environment, it's very difficult, very harsh environment on brick and mortar. If you see any little chunks of brick laying on your roof after the winter and the spring, or if you can get up there or have a qualified person climb up and take a look at the cap on the chimney, any little cracks that are in there, they're on a horizontal surface. So, you know, if any water or ice gets inside there and expands, typically by the end of winter, they actually get larger, and eventually those tend to work their way in the home too. So on the inside of the home, you might see some water staining around the chimney or above a fireplace, and that's usually an indicator that there might be something wrong with the chimney flashing or the mortar, or need some tuck pointing or chimney cap or something like that too.
Mike Wood is sales manager at Milwaukee's Callan Construction. He talked with Stephanie Lecce last spring about the impact of the freeze-thaw cycle on homes. You can find links to all of WUWM's stories and interviews about the cold, the so-called polar vortex, from WUWM.com. A break now, and in just a moment, the head of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF on the organization's progress in reducing childhood deaths in the developing world. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. Children everywhere are among the most vulnerable parts of the population, but no more so than in the developing world. Despite exponential increases in modern medicine, children in countries such as Sierra Leone and Bangladesh face diseases long ago eradicated in much of the world. Carol Stern has traveled to many of those troubled places. She's president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, which supports humanitarian work in more than 190 countries around the world. The organization touts its drive toward zero, zero children's deaths from conditions that can be prevented, treated, or cured. It's that effort that underpins Stern's book, I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children, which brought her to Milwaukee in the fall. Ahead of that visit, she joined us on the line from UNICEF's Chicago office. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
The book and one of the chapters in the book and really an entire campaign through UNICEF is called I Believe in Zero. How close are we to the zero you are seeking?
Well, you know, today, as we are talking to each other, 18,000 children will die today, all under the age of five. all from causes we already know how to prevent and are just not doing our job. So we're 18,000 away from zero today.
How quickly can we expect changes in the places where UNICEF works? Take, for example, the situation you write about in Sierra Leone, in which a fairly expensive vaccine could make a huge difference in eradicating tetanus. How quickly can change come in a situation like that?
Well, to give you some context, you know, in the 1980s, over 30,000 kids were dying every single day. And so, you know, in the ensuing 30 years, we have halved that number. And the world's population during that period has tripled. So theoretically, if we had done nothing, there would be 90,000 kids dying every day. And when you think about the success rate, it's pretty remarkable. I always say, I wish I had a product that I had made that could show that success rate, because then I could finance what needs to happen for the world's children. So, you know, and in recent years, it's been more accelerated. You know, it isn't like it's a constant coming down every year. It has been more accelerated. So I would hope that in my lifetime, I will see that zero. To take a place like Sierra Leone, you know, the disease of tetanus, it will never be completely eradicated because it's a spore that lives on the ground. But we can eliminate it, and we have successfully eliminated it around the world in all but 20-something countries at this point.
You personally were not necessarily always involved in issues involving the world's children. How long did it take you not just to fully embrace the mission of UNICEF, but to embrace the role that you play in the organization?
You know, I came to UNICEF thinking I knew what it was about. you know, I had had 30 plus years in the nonprofit world, and I could lead any organization. And oh my God, it's kids! I'm so passionate. So I took my first trip, and that's where the book starts. I took my first trip to Mozambique, and I was in a clinic in the middle of nowhere with a mom who had just given birth, and you know, I very smiley faced and happy. Young woman, is this your first child? And she so matter-of-factly looked me in the face and said, well, it's the first one that lived. And I, in that moment, realized, you know, I'm not in Kansas anymore, Dorothy, and I really need to take a step back and talk to people and hear what their lives are like and see what their lives are like and touch and feel and experience it myself.
This is not just another nonprofit.
No, it's not. And it's not only just a nonprofit because of the just vast diversity of what UNICEF does every day somewhere in the globe, but it is managed well, it is a well-oiled machine on the one hand, and at the same time able to turn on a dime and be innovative and be tenacious, and is some of the most remarkable people I've ever had the privilege to work with.
You often compare your mission and the circumstances of the children you meet to your own family's experience in the Holocaust and in Nazi-occupied Europe. Why do you see that as such a powerful and appropriate comparison?
Well, you know, because my mom came to this country at the age of 6 years old with her brother, who was four. They were brought here by a woman whose last name they know, but whose first name they never knew, whom they never saw again. And so from a very early age, I learned from my mom repeatedly that one person can make a difference, because I wouldn't be here if not for this woman. And at the same time, my grandfather was on a boat, the SS St. Louis, which is often called the Voyage of the Damned, which wasn't allowed to dock anywhere in the world. And ultimately, most of its passengers, you know, it returned to Europe and most of its passengers perished. But my grandfather lived, and I heard his story, too. He sat in a harbor outside of Cuba for 40 days while the world debated, what do we do with these people? And everybody, even the U.S., turned, you know, we turned our back on them. And so I also heard very early on what it means to not give a damn, to not be part of the solution. So it's not at all unusual that both my brother and I ended up in giving and caring professions, because that's the lesson we got at home from our earliest ages.
At one point, you reference advice you were given. I think it was going into one of the refugee camps in Darfur, but I might be mistaken. But the advice was you shouldn't promise anything, because the field staff, for as good as it is, might not be equipped to deliver on that promise. It must be hard to see such suffering and at the same time not be able to promise anything specific except that you will try to help.
It's really hard. It's really hard sometimes, even something as silly as knowing I have a bag of Jolly Ranchers in my backpack and there's children in front of me, and I find myself mentally counting, you know, how many kids and how many do I think I have in the bag? because, you know, you don't want to take it out and give it to one child, right? Something as simple as a piece of candy, and then you know, multiply that when it's the glass of water that stands between life and death. Or it's the mom you're looking at, you know, straight in the eyes, knowing that 70 cents would have bought the vaccine that would have saved her child, and that you spend more than that on your cup of coffee every morning.
Well, so how do you cope with it?
How do you cope with it? You know, I wish I had a really good answer. The best answer I can give you is some days better than others. You know, people always say to me, how do you not cry? When my response is, what makes you think I don't? I'm not a superhuman, and I definitely cry. I've shed a lot of tears out there. But I also have seen the tenacity of human spirit. I've seen that the children of the world don't see themselves as victims. They're survivors of heroic things and horrific things. And that they believe so dearly that tomorrow could be better that you can't help but get caught up in their optimism.
Well, and I would imagine it would be really easy to have everything you do be driven by guilt of, you know, that you're leaving there at the end of the day or the week, or guilt that you're going home to your family, which, you know, has everything in comparison to the people that you're with.
Yeah, but I will also tell you that there are lots of things in some of the developing nations that we've lost sight of that are remarkable. You know, I talk about it in the book, how I would go to some of the poorest villages, and as the jeeps would drive in, people pour out of their huts and they sing to you, because all they have is to give you is their voice. And I've probably been sung to that way, I don't know, maybe 50 or 100 times now. And that's the time I've never made it without crying. It is the most magnificent sound you will ever hear. Or I went with women who have to go and fetch the water, and that they sing and dance their way to the river, and there's a sense of community that I don't feel in my hometown that is remarkable. None of these make up for or replace the things that they need, but there are things we can learn from these people. And I guess that's the big lesson for me in all of this, is I came in thinking I knew it. I realized I knew nothing. And I never really had thought about before I took the job how much I would learn as I went through it all.
One of the other really powerful recurrent images is this idea that pretty much everywhere you have gone, there are scenes of children really just being children.
Oh, absolutely. I always said there were three things that have been the same no matter where I go. And the first is that wherever there are kids, there is some kind of ball. You know, I mean, it's like man is inherently, you know, we have to play with a ball. Because, you know, in the U.S., it's leather, it's plastic, and in most of the nations I go to, it's rags tied with string. But in absolutely every place I've ever been, some kid is kicking it and some kid is kicking it back. And they're laughing. Or when a baby is born, no matter how poor the family is, that baby's healthy, there is rejoicing. And there is love. It's amazing. So one is the ball. The second is that my lap is not my property. You know, if I sit on the ground long enough in any place in the world, a kid is going to come and sit on me. It's phenomenal. They don't speak my language. They don't ask permission. They just kind of plop down. And it feels just as good anywhere in the world to have a kid who you don't know feel safe with you. But the third thing is that we all want the same things for our kids. We want them to be happy. We want them to be healthy. We want them to go to bed with their bellies full. We want them to dream really, really, really big dreams. And we want to be part of making those dreams come true.
Do you also see a takeaway message for people, you know, living in cities in this country, places like Milwaukee, where there are also crises in children's health, things like infant mortality and really similar situations where otherwise preventable diseases are, if not common, certainly more common in these places than they are in more affluent communities?
Well, I think that if a child suffers, no matter what their geography is, it's horrible. So it isn't a matter of which place is worse. It shouldn't be an either. It's an and. But there are some advantages in the United States. When a child is born in the U.S., even a migrant child, the child gets a birth certificate. They exist. There's some record of their existence. We have laws that define them as a child until they reach 18. Education is not a privilege in this country. It's a law and it's a right. You know, you're mandated to go. So there's public schools without fees. In order to go to those schools, you have to be immunized, so immunizations are made available to children. There is a shelter system. No hospital will turn a baby that's dying away. There is all kinds of things that we have that the developing world does not have.
So even as you're trying to do things to directly impact children's health, provide vaccines and make these changes, is it also UNICEF's role to work behind the scenes to try to pressure these countries into making policy changes like something as simple as birth certificates?
Absolutely. You know, we work upstream as well as downstream. So we work to get school fees eliminated. We work to get birth registries in place. You know, again, I'll go back to Haiti. After the earthquake, the first night, the main thing that I needed to do was to go out and try and get as many digital cameras as I could possibly get my hands on. And then when I flew into Haiti, we were literally taking pictures of kids and creating registries because children got separated from their families, and it was many weeks till you knew who was dead, who was alive, where people were. And you had a lot of people trying to claim children were theirs who weren't theirs. And so we started to create registries there. So sometimes we're actually doing it. Sometimes we are working to abolish school fees. You know, all over Africa, we've had school fees abolished in many countries, making it possible for a poor child to go to school.
Have you gotten any better at dealing with bugs?
No. I want to say yes, but my kids will tell you no. I'm still like that woman who stands on the chair when the spider's on the floor. No, I haven't. I hate things that crawl. When I was getting ready to go to Sudan, and I went through this entire security training class, and I was fine when I was learning, you know, what do you do if they want to take your Jeep? What do you do if somebody wants to shoot at you? I mean, I was really fine on all of that. And then we got to the, how do you shake your sleeping bag out to make sure there's no scorpion? And I almost didn't go on the trip.
Well, Carol Stern, we will try to keep the bugs out of Milwaukee while you are here.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. That's why I like to travel much better in the winter.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your story and the story of UNICEF with us.
Well, thank you so much. And if anyone is interested, unicefusa.org, you can find out lots of information about how to get involved.
Carol Stern is the president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF and author of the book, I Believe in Zero, Learning from the World's Children, published by St. Martin's Press. We spoke with her in October before an appearance at the Milwaukee Public Library. Another break now, and then young adult author and Milwaukee native Jane Kelly talks about her latest title. This is Like Effect from WUWM. Like Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Just a few minutes ago, we heard about UNICEF's efforts to help children around the world who are thrown into desperate circumstances not of their making. The young heroine of writer Jane Kelly's latest novel is also facing tough circumstances. 11-year-old Alia is fighting leukemia, but she's been weakened so much that it's hard for her to exert any effort to do just about anything. But a chance meeting with a precocious parrot shakes up her world. And it should be said, the parrot's world as well. The book is called The Desperate Adventures of Zeno and Alia, and Jane Kelly joined us in the studio to talk about it. Welcome back to Lake Effect.
Thank you. It is always a pleasure to talk to you, Mitch.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk with you as well. What got you interested in parrots?
Well, I happened to see an article by Dr. Pepperberg about her studies with the very famous Alex. And he is a very, very, or was, I should say, because he sadly died in 2007, a very, very smart bird. But she purchased him just almost randomly at a pet store outside of Chicago. And so he wasn't bred to be particularly brilliant, but it turned out that he was because he could identify shapes and colors and concepts like numbers. And he seemed to have an intelligence that went way beyond everyone's expectations. So that intrigued me.
Well, and in fact, you know, you think of how the term parrot is sometimes used, and it's really not necessarily a positive depiction. You know, when you say someone is parroting somebody else, they're just copying.
That's right. And that was part of the struggle that Dr. Pepperberg had to get people to fund her scientific research because they thought, well, what are you trying to study birds for? They have bird-sized brains. They aren't even as smart as dolphins. But she found that – I think she put Alex's intelligence at about the level of a 5-year-old human, but his emotional intelligence was about a 2-year-old.
Well, so you were thinking about parrots, but that doesn't necessarily automatically translate to a character in every author's mind. What got you wanting to get inside the head of a parrot?
Well, I think it had more to do with the amount of time that I spent thinking about them, which was just, you know, authors get obsessed by things, to be honest. And this was one of my obsessions. And I even considered the fact that I maybe would want to own a parrot. But then the more research I did about them, the more I realized that they were very difficult pets. You couldn't even really call them pets. And so I decided that I better sort of exercise my obsession in this fictional fashion, which was really a lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed the time that I spent thinking about this character, Zeno.
Well, and so there is both a scientific basis for Zeno's ability to learn, but there's quite a lot that is speculative because none of us can actually know what's going on in the head of a parrot.
That's right. That's right. So for me, the key, I think, was when I read about one of Dr. Pepperberg's studies where she was trying to figure out basically how to teach Alex. And she discovered that he was motivated very much by the sense that someone else was learning more than he. So if he was not functioning in, you know, paying attention to the study, she would get one of her human assistants to come in, and the human assistant would do the task better than Alex, or sometimes worse, and Alex would just bristle and say, oh, well, he could do it as well, too. So once I understood that there really was an emotional component to the thinking that birds were doing, that really fascinated me, and that became an important part of what I imagined for my character.
Well, and so Zeno is a very self-focused parrot, which I think lines up with the idea of someone with fairly young emotional intelligence.
Yes. Yes. But I think also that I was, you know, well, let's just face it. We all know people who are really focused on how much they know and very arrogant about their intelligence, but they are not very sensitive to what other people are doing. And so I suppose Zeno was, in a way, my caricature of certain over-intellectuals who have very little wisdom. And so this is part of Zeno's journey, is that as he is forced out into the real world and he must encounter other kinds of birds and then humans, he must learn the wisdom of life experiences and not just rely upon his clever Greek phrases.
Well, it's striking that Zeno doesn't really grasp the concept of what a friend is.
That's true. He does not, even though he has quite a fondness for his owner. I should perhaps explain a little bit. The book begins as Zeno's owner, who is a professor of Greek literature, dies of a heart attack. And this propels Zeno out into the world. So he is close to his owner, but because the owner probably was a little bit like Zeno himself, a little less, you know, his emotional intelligence was not as great as his academic intelligence. I think the two of them were just a couple of curmudgeons living in their library. And so Zeno didn't really have the kind of friendship that he ultimately, in the course of the novel, develops first with a pigeon and then with the girl.
This seems like as good a time as any to hear a little bit, because the book opens with us getting to know Zeno.
All right. So this is the way the book begins. An alarm buzzed. A phone rang. Theme music from a news program played. A clock chimed 10, 11, 12, 13 times. The alarm buzzed again, louder and louder and louder. No one turned it off. No one got up and put food in the shiny aluminum bowl that was, alas, completely empty. The source of all these sounds rapped his beak on top of the bookcase. The house was silent for a moment, as if everything in it, even the walls of leather-bound books, hoped for a response. There was none. So the alarm buzzed, the phone rang, the music played, the clock chimed, the alarm buzzed, and a raucous voice proclaimed, "Zeno wants!" Zeno was an African gray parrot. He could imitate 63 sounds and speak 127 words. Since those two were by far his favorites, he repeated them again. Zeno wants! He flapped his gray wings and spread his tail that was as scarlet as the lining of a magician's cape. Then he flew over to the shiny aluminum bowl. He cocked his head to one side to see if his servant had filled it with food. There were no nuts, no fruits, no greens, nothing except Zeno's own reflection. He flew over to perch on the desk so he could look down at his servant. Dr. Agard was still sleeping on the floor. Zeno didn't understand this. Dr. Agard was a man of regular habits. He had never lain down on the floor for even a moment in the 20 years that he had been Zeno's servant. He had certainly never slept there. Zeno wants! And what did Zeno want? Since you are no doubt much better at understanding your feelings than poor Zeno, you know that Zeno wanted Dr. Agard to get up. He wanted the life they had shared for 20 years to continue. He wanted not to feel alone in the house. He wanted to be rid of that little throbbing knot of fear and dread in his stomach. He wanted...
Banana nut!
Zeno squawked. Well, he wasn't the only one who thought everything would be all right if he could just eat his favorite food.
Jane Kelly reading from The Desperate Adventures of Zeno and Alia. We find out that, of course, as you say, the person whom Zeno thinks of as his servant has died, and Zeno doesn't really grasp the concept of death early on very well. There's a character that knows only too well what death means. Where did Alia come from?
Alia is a young girl, and she has a kind of leukemia. I suppose she came most specifically from the fact that I have had cancer myself. And while I never really intend to write about cancer, because who wants to write about cancer, still I find that it has crept into various of my novels in different ways. And so I was particularly interested in the concept of identity because for me, while I had cancer, that was the worst part, was the fact that no one saw me as myself anymore. They saw me as cancer patient, cancer victim, cancer survivor, but still someone who was pretty much defined by their illness. And that interested me. The other part that interested me was how easy it is to sort of slip into a very passive relationship with because the doctors are always telling you what to do. Everyone has all kinds of advice, and the person who is sick can sometimes start feeling like their will means nothing. And so Alia in this story has been having her treatments and lost a lot of her strength and has sort of sunk into her bed, and just which is very contrast from the Alia that she used to be, a very active soccer-playing young girl, and she doesn't know who she is anymore. And then she has this encounter with Zeno when he pretty much randomly appears at her bedroom window because of the banana nut muffin.
Well, and you say she's lost much of her strength. She has also really lost much of her will.
Yes, yes. The two go hand in hand, I think, because, you know, if you don't get up and do things, you realize that you can't get up and do things. You know, we are what we do. And she has not been able to do much.
What is the challenge to you in writing about a life-threatening illness when your audience is so young?
Oh, it's very difficult because I was aware of the fact that some of the children who are reading this book might actually have such an illness or might know someone who has such an illness. And I did not want to alarm them. But on the other hand, I feel a responsibility to treat these sorts of subjects with a certain amount of realism because children know a great deal more than we give them credit for. So it's a fine line that one has to draw. And since it is a middle grade novel, it certainly has to have a happy ending. But I wanted to make sure that that was justified by the events within the book.
It seems like the audience that you're writing for is a really pivotal audience. I mean, this is, you know, the middle grades are a really formative set of years for kids.
Yes. That is why I love writing for middle grade, because it is a time of transition. Part of their lives are still very much in the worlds of imaginings and fancifulness, and yet they are starting to grapple with some very important issues that we, even as adults, struggle with. Questions of identity, questions of how do we find our way in the world? How do we choose our friends? How do we react when we lose our friends? And so the more fantastical elements, I wish that the children would continue to carry along with them, because I think even we as adults, they comfort us. The idea that the birds are all looking out for each other, which plays an important part of this book, well, that's not something that I could realistically know, but that's something that I, as an adult, certainly hope that the animals have community in the way that we have community.
I don't think it was you, but there was a middle grade author I interviewed who also pointed out that it's so much easier to write for kids when you don't have to include kissing in the story.
Well, if I hadn't said that, I certainly would say that, because it's true. There doesn't have to be the issues like kissing or some of the more unpleasant aspects of being a teenager. We can sort of glide past those.
It's a different brand of angst.
That's right. That's right.
Well, Jane Kelly, thank you so much, and congratulations on another wonderful novel.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Milwaukee area native Jane Kelly is the author of three novels for young readers, the latest of which is called The Desperate Adventures of Zeno and Alia, and there is a link to more about it from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One last break, and then an essayist has some thoughts on how to get through the cabin fever that starts to build this time of year. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. It was back to school for most Milwaukee area kids this morning after a couple of days off because of the extreme cold. And just in time for many of them. Unlike a typical snow day, it wasn't the sort of weather you'd want to go out sledding or to build a snowman. So a lot of kids spent a lot of time inside this week. But cabin fever affects young and old alike, as Lake Effect essayist George Burdies can attest.
There isn't a vaccine for it. And even if there were, it would probably be in short supply, restricted to young children and the elderly. No, it's not the flu. It's that other seasonal malady fast approaching. Experts describe the problem as having a regional climatic dimension. Sufferers are predominantly located in the rural snowbound areas of the upper Midwest. The first symptoms of retching blahs are usually reported in mid-January. February can bring on epidemic levels of grunts, moans, and foam-mouthed growls toward loved ones. The severity of all this is usually in direct ratio to snow depth. Its intensity is heightened even more by persistent gray skies. A taunting postcard from friends in Florida or Arizona can cause devastating spasms. Such pictorial reminders of other warm, sunny places can crank up violent storms of angst, junk, funk, and dreary melancholy. Such is the heavy burden and toll of cabin fever. For some, the best elixir are picture puzzles in front of the fireplace every evening. For others, the attempted treatment is alcohol. That only produces other, even more serious problems. There is also this absolute given about cabin fever. one infection does not provide guaranteed immunity against subsequent annual sieges. It can also be contagious. What about avoidance strategies? The best and most promising is to stay productively busy. Being your own best friend in an isolated cabin in the woods can do wonders. Getting out, despite the challenge of icy roads and 20 below zero temperatures, is also highly recommended. Generally, embracing active winter sports like cross-country skiing and snowshoeing is also a sure prevention. Cures for the afflicted are a little more elusive. Summer tans and spirits fade quickly in what Shakespeare called the long night that never finds the day. But turning on every light in the house can also turn on a malingering spirit. Even when the electric bill arrives, it's important to remember that it's cheaper than the doctor's bill. The dazzling effect of a full moon's magic on a silent, snow-covered forest offers the sun worthy competition. In my experience, the ultimate answer to cabin fever is just good old-fashioned pride, determined hardiness, and grit. Among my friends and neighbors up here in the White Woods of Wisconsin, there is a genuine awe at the breathtaking beauty of this place in winter. The soft stillness is a gift unsurpassed. Add to that the pride of self-sufficiency, the survivor's achievement of having done it, and you come out a winner. Olympic gold medalists know the feeling. Sure, there'll be some mud in March, but come April, the lakes begin to open up, and then the eagles are back, and then the loons. It's long about then that the snowbirds start returning. You know that feathered species. They have sand between their toes and flaunted suntans. Hardy survivors welcome them back with open arms, of course. They swing open their cabin door to them. But there's one thing they definitely do not do. Good taste and dignity preclude that. They never tell the snowbirds all the good things they missed during their absence. That would be too cruel.
Lake Effect essayist George Burdies lives part of the year in the North Woods and now deals with his wintertime cabin fever from Milwaukee. Many of his essays first appeared on radio station WXPR in Rhinelander and on his blog, East of Eagle River. He's sharing them now with us as well. I'm Mitch Teich. The temperature is at least inching its way up. I hope you have a chance to maybe venture out today. Thanks so much for tuning in. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock, we'll check in with our foreign policy contributor about the deteriorating situations in Lebanon and in South Sudan, among other places. Plus, we'll hear about the long-awaited production of War Horse coming to Milwaukee this week. I hope you'll join us for that tomorrow morning at 10 on Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.